Right. Dr. Aaron Carroll is here. He joins us almost every week for an hour, and we're very excited to have him and take your calls. A bunch of you called talking healthcare a lot today. So if you called earlier and I told you to call now for Dr. Carroll, do it. 866-994-6343. 866-99-INDY is the phone number. Aaron Carroll is on Twitter at Aaron E. Carroll. Two R's, two L's. He's a professor of pediatrics. He's the director of the Center for Health Policy and Professionalism Research at Indiana University and the author of Don't Swallow Your Gum, Myths, Half-Truths, and Outright Lies About Your Body and Your Health. And his most recent book is Don't Crush Your Eyes, They'll Get Stuck That Way. And, of course, he blogs at The Incidental Economist and is now a contributor to The Upshot at TheNewYorkTimes.com. He joins us now. You know, we've been talking a lot of parenting on the new show here, Dr. Carroll, and really? And I wonder, you know, pediatricians have a really interesting point of view on parenting because they deal constantly with parents and their concerns. I wonder how much you think a parent can benefit from reading parenting books and learning child psychology, learning how to listen to your kids. And there's all these different ideologies out there about, you know, what the best way to the parent is, but the variables are so different in the child and the parent. It's a weird research field.
Well, here's the thing. It's like, but the part of it is, God, you know, it's one of those where I don't think that there is like a randomized controlled trial proven best way to parent. But I do think that it is one of those subjects where we don't spend enough time sort of openly discussing it. And part of it is one of those things where there's so many areas of life where we don't have an actual answer, but it, part of it is just the quest to try to learn and figure out and discuss and see what works and what doesn't. And so I totally think reading the books just to get a sense of what is out there and what is available and what you might be, try to do differently is huge. My wife and I have often said that one of the best things about being a pediatrician, especially, you know, in sort of the office, is I get to see so many different ways that people are parenting. Because I see parents interacting with their kids. And I used to say all the time when I was a resident in clinic that the best value that I get is I come home with 10 new things I was never going to do. Because you have the opportunity just to see in sort of just a natural laboratory what people are doing. And sometimes you're like, God, that is just not a good idea. And you save yourself the trouble. But so I think that there's probably tons to be gained by just exploring it and thinking about it and talking about it. But there is no one book that I would point to and say, you know, that's the one, or, you know, someone has figured it out and they have the magic way that is the best way to parent. I don't think there's an answer for that, but I do think it is the kind of thing where we could all do a better job of trying to learn more about it and trying to figure it out collectively.
Are you familiar with Dr. Chaim Gnat, his book Between Parent and Child?
No, I am not.
That's the book that I've read and I just absolutely love. I mean, I got to be honest. I think I like a lot of these kind of far more progressive styles of parenting, if you will. And we had Alfie Cohn on the other day, who's got a new book called The Myth of the Spoiled Child.
Yeah, I've heard of that one. Yes.
Yeah, you're not a fan?
I know, it's not that I'm not a fan. I just don't know. Part of it is just that I don't know. You know, and I want to say that out loud. It's like I don't think that, you know, that I have an answer, but I believe less than anybody else has an answer. I think that, you know, Amy and I talk about it all the time, and I, you know, it's almost as if I think there are just a few simple rules that are good to follow. It's like, you know, I think that the consistency is incredibly important. I think that setting boundaries and holding to them and, you know, offering choice when choice is permissible. And, you know, sort of giving them kids, you know, setting sort of the rules, but giving them the freedom to, I mean, it's like none of this I invented. It's just sort of like these are the things that we've done. And I do think you can spoil a child. I, on the other hand, think that we probably, you know, go too far, especially with babies. I think that it's impossible to spoil a baby.
Obviously, we're going to talk a lot about the Affordable Care Act. But before we get to it, I wanted to ask you something. You know how this is personal, obviously, but you know how like everybody that knows me well, especially my family, all thinks that I get that Dr. Carroll is my God and I give him too much credit for everything. Right. So. But here's my thing about you. And I want to try to get an answer from you on this. But You know, yes. So we have this great pediatrician. I've not met him, but my wife absolutely loves him. He's got this kind of holistic approach and, you know, and so on. But he's not like an herbalist or something. He believes in vaccines and so on, although he's a little wishy-washy on HPV. He says he's not quite sure about it. And apparently, I just found out that my kids didn't get the flu shot, which I found strange. But here's the thing, though. Regardless of this pediatrician, I went on his Facebook page and I thought it was interesting to see. He's a really great guy, and he's really great with the kids and the parents, and gets rave reviews by everybody. But it's interesting that doctors, not just pediatricians, and you're a pediatrician, how they evolve. It's got to be a very difficult job being a doctor because. New practices come out, new research comes out. It changes what we might have once believed on a treatment, on a drug. And it's hard to know if that research, how effective it is, how well it was done, the methodology, and so on. Mm-hmm. And so I want my question to you is, how do doctors know what's best practice? Because they're getting bombarded just the way we are with new research. And why I think that I give Dr. Carroll so much credit is because your job is no longer as a practicing pediatrician, that you practice very little, but your job is researching the research. So you look at all of the research and aggregate all the research and come away with a conclusion. I don't think that's what most doctors' primary purpose is. Or what they do. That's I don't think people realize the field that you're in, what it is.
Right.
And unfortunately, that's why I think they take credit away from you to some extent. But that's explain to me how the normal doctor practices every day, sees patients every day, can know what's best.
There was like a paper, and it was a long time ago. So, I mean, this was even before we had even this much research coming out every day, that said if you said this year I'm going to read – you know, all the papers that are published, pick your field, and you said, I'm going to read two a day, and you just were going to read the ones published in that year, it would take the rest of your life. It is absolutely impossible for anybody to try to stay current with all the research that is out there. And that's a real problem in the sense that, you know, how do doctors go? We say go to four years of college. I mean, all the school that comes before that, then 4 years of medical school, then 3 to 5 years of residency, maybe a couple years of fellowship where all you're doing is training. And then we say, stop. Now go be a doctor full time for the rest of your life and magically by osmosis, get up to date every day. And we try to get a hold of this by doing licensing and making people take boards, but that doesn't really work. And we try to require that they take what we call continuing medical education to try to think that, you know, by spending a couple days a year learning, they'll keep up to speed. But all the research shows us that people only take CME in the stuff that they're already very good at, because that's just human nature and what people do. So most doctors probably don't. And it's not their fault. They have real jobs, which is to take care of patients and to be immersed in that. And that's not a moral judgment. I don't do that. And that's where, you know, it's the opposite. It's like I spend very little time in patient care. I will never be a master clinician. When we're in clinic, you know, I have a self-deprecating joke that when I see a kid that's really sick, I turn to one of my residents. I'm like, yeah, we need to get a real doctor for this. Because it's, you know, because it's like I own my limitations. And I am not, you know, the best clinician is going to be.
I wonder
the time.
But I wonder how often a doctor, you know, will see the same thing, strep, okay, over and over and over. They treat it the same way over and over and over, and it works. But sometimes I wonder, though, if a, because of their own experience, we talk about anecdotes and anecdotal experience, life experience constantly, you know, they might not be treating something the best way because their experience says this works. It usually works with my patient. Why would I need to read the New England Journal of Medicine? Why would I need to continuing education? I know what works because I'm actually doing it every day.
Thought, and it's like, you know, people have written about this, and it's all, you know, who knows, but you have to also own that that and it's the dirty secret of medicine, the vast majority of stuff that we do is not proven by any research or evidence. It is sort of like, this is what I was trained, and so, you know, for a lot of things that we treat and a lot of things that we do, it is like, well, this is my experience, this is what works best, and that's fine. And if someone's doing else something different, that is also sometimes fine, because we just don't know, which is why I think it's important when we actually have research that finally proves, like, oh, my God, this is the thing that works. We should be doing that. And that's why I get passionate about, you know, some of the things that we talk about in the show, because when we finally have a preponderance of evidence, that says, oh my God, do this, that's rare. We should be thrilled. We should all own that. But disseminating that out to actual practicing clinicians is very difficult. Doctors are human beings, just like everybody else, and they are subject to biases, and they are subject to, you know, preconceived notions, and, you know, they believe tons of things that are myths. I mean, that's how we got our first book. Was we just even started. It was a paper in the BMG. It was called Medical Myths Even Doctors Believe. Because doctors are human, and they were taught some of these things by mom, or they were taught some of these things by teachers, or they were taught some of these things by other doctors, and they, you know, that is where a lot of this stuff gets started and how it keeps continuing. And it is not feasible to expect physicians to be, you know, scouring the medical literature every day to try to remain utterly current on what the latest research is. That's a full-time job. It happens to be one of my jobs. But that's not what doctors are going to do, nor would you want them to. If they spent all day reading that, they wouldn't be very good at what they do.
Are you leaving me for John Green?
Never.
We're talking to Dr. Aaron Carroll, who does a video every week. It gets a tremendous amount of attention. It's called Healthcare Triage on YouTube. You should watch it. He does a Q&A on this latest one with his new boyfriend that he's replacing me for.
No, I am not.
I will be out there in Indianapolis the 17th, 18th, and 19th. Where Dr.
Yeah.
Carroll works, and Dr. Carroll's going to be coming to all the shows. So a lot of people, as the last time I was out, are far more excited to meet you than me. So by all means, if that helps sell tickets, I'll use whatever I can. Morty's Comedy Joint, April 17th through 19th in Indianapolis. Aaron and I will both be there for five shows. Now, the flu. You have a recent post at the Incidental Economist. About what is the flu? What is the vaccine? Does it work?
The flu is influenza. It's a respiratory illness that has existed for God, I don't know how long. It comes back every year. It's a slightly different strain every year, but it comes back. And there is a vaccine, and they have to develop the vaccine every year because, as I said, the strain is different every year. And the vaccine absolutely works. You know, it's like there's research that shows it reduces the, you know, the chance of getting the flu massively. It reduces the symptoms if you do get it. It keeps kids, and the study I published on this weekend showed, like, it keeps kids out of the ICU. In other words, it keeps them from getting massively.
When you say the flu shot, the vaccine, it's a vaccine, that
yeah.
it works,
yeah.
Does that mean if I get the flu shot, I cannot get the
no.
flu?
It means no vaccine is 100% effective. It means that it significantly reduces the chance of you getting the flu, and often it significantly reduces the severity of the illness if you do get it.
So if you do get it, you could still get it, but it wouldn't hit you as hard because of the vaccine.
Often, yes, but it's like, but you also have a significantly lower chance of getting it. In other words, it's like it's a less chance that you're going to get it.
Why would a doctor be wishy-washy on that one?
Because again, it's like you turn on the TV and you see quote unquote experts saying all the time the exact opposite of what I just said with no evidence.
There's got to be some evidence out there that a doctor would rely on that the flu shot is not effective or could potentially be dangerous.
They'll say like it's not 100% effective, but no vaccine is 100% effective. Or they'll say things like, well, you know, because it has to be developed each year, it's possible that, you know, some years it won't be as effective as others. Yes, but you know that doesn't seem to happen. Or they will say, oh, you know, well, you know, the H1N1 is new and that doesn't cover that. And it's like, well, it does. They come up with sort of rationalization.
Well, what about that? Because that's a lot of people say, that the flu shot doesn't work because it depends on last year's strain.
That's the way it's always been, and we keep doing research on how effective it is the next year, and it is effective. I mean, they don't have a magic foreseeing one for the research flu shots. These are all the flu shots that fall under the things that you know, the way it works now. The way it works now is every year it's a best guess. And when we do the research year after year after year, and most of these studies are not one flu shot, they're over the course of years, year after year after year, it works because that's the theory behind it. They're similar enough that it reduces your chance of getting flu significantly. But my biggest problem is that, we have come in this country to sort of discuss vaccine policy as a, like, it's a personal choice and I'm making it about my health. And that's fine. You know, it's like, I get that, you know, and if you as an adult want to, you know, take your chances, I guess I understand that, the philosophy of, you know, freedom and individuality, it's all fine. But you have to recognize that, especially when we're talking about kids, one of the major reasons that we vaccinate people is to protect the kids, protect the people that are in danger. You're protecting babies. You're protecting the elderly. You're protecting the chronically ill. Because when we vaccinate and we get enough immunity going around, there's a much lower chance that the disease is percolating in the community and that you're going to give it to someone. One of the greatest studies that I love to show all the time is that when we only give the chickenpox vaccine to kids 1 year and older. And one of the great things that they showed in New York City a number of years ago was that as they started giving the chickenpox vaccine to children, again, 1 year and older, the number of babies that went to the hospital with chickenpox, and that's really bad. I mean, a baby with chickenpox is a really serious illness, dropped to zero. Because we were doing such a good job of vaccinating everybody else and getting the disease sort of out of the natural environment in homes, that babies weren't being exposed to it, and babies were now not going to the hospital with a major illness. You do this to protect others. You get the flu shot sometimes to protect your elderly, the people that you love, to protect the children and babies who might be at risk, to protect people who have chronic illness like asthma or other diseases who are around you where influenza can be much more serious, to get it out of the community. And we've gotten to this argument of like, well, I just want to protect me and I want to protect. And it's very, you know, with no evidence, by the way, because the dangers are totally oversold, that we let this stuff keep cropping up. And this is why you read about outbreaks and it's like a ton of people all of a sudden go to the hospital. It's not that one person, you know, the person that didn't get the vaccine is the one that got sick. They infected a ton of other people as well. It's not just a danger to you. You become a danger to those around you. And it is a communal problem. And we you know, a lot of the research that goes in tries, you know, in fact, I think I was just on a paper recently that talked about altruism with respect to vaccination. And we lose sight of that, and we don't talk about it enough. But it's not, you know, you don't just vaccinate to protect yourself. You do it to protect everybody else as well. In fact, do it to protect the people that need the protection the most.
Talking to Dr. Aaron Carroll. He's on Twitter, at Aaron E. Carroll. Give him a follow, a question there. If you want to talk about the Affordable Care Act, we're about to make that turn. 866-994-6343 is the phone number to call. Lice is in my school. My daughter's school. That's not a big deal, is it? I mean, all the parents are going out of their minds. All the moms are freaking out about it. I think they're freaking out about it because I think, like so often we do, they think it's a reflection on them that they're not they're not washing their kids, that their home is unkept. What is lice? What is its danger?
Honey, it's funny that you bring it up.
They just called me honey. I was like, all right.
I said it's funny because Amy, if she's, I don't think she's listening, but if she was, she would know
she.
How badly I'm rolling my eyes right now. Because we do this every summer, or spring and fall, I guess, as well. But it's like, it is just this panic that if there's lice, that like somehow the world is going to come to an end. And I've never quite understood this because it's like, you know, lice have been around forever. And it's like, again, we have much better tools and cleanliness now than we did long time ago. And it's not as if the world came to an end because of lice. I do understand that it is difficult and that, you know, if it gets into hair, especially into, like, if it got into my daughter's hair, it'd be very hard to get out without having to, like, you know, cut it off perhaps. So it's like, I do understand.
It's really hard. That's my wife's concern. She's like, the problem is, it takes forever. You got to go through every damn hair to get it out. You're shaking your head. Yes, Melanie, did you have lice?
No, I never.
Turn her mic is off. Sorry. Go ahead.
I never.
Just then go ahead to Melanie. I can't see who you're talking to.
Go ahead, Melanie.
Yeah, I never had lice, but I got stripped down and put in with my friends and neighbors all in a shower, and our moms put on these gloves and washed all this awful stuff in our hair and took combs and just.
While fully naked?
I was going to say, you just make
we were
that.
Young.
Oh, really?
We were young. This is very elementary school, but I still remember it.
Right.
Absolutely, because they were paranoid that we were all going to get lice because there was an outbreak. And
how do you explain that group shower you took last week?
Well, that was just for fun.
Oh, all right. So the lice issue is not a real health concern. It's just annoyance.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say it's not. It's probably actually really not. There's very little, like, actual disease that comes in the end. I mean, it's not like, you know, there's a scourge and that people are going to get other illnesses or they're carrying major disease. The problem is that lice are hardy. And, you know, if you don't sort of treat them, then they can get on the pillows, they can get, you know, in hats, they can, you know, the nits start moving around, you can worry about giving it to other children. So it is, as always, prevention is better than treatment. And so people want to nip it in the bud. Having said that, Yeah, it is somewhat, I think, of an overreaction in the sense of like watching how the community sometimes reacts to lice and to going crazy. It's like as if I always say, like, you know, there are no children that, you know, don't recover. It's like it always gets better.
The concern about the flu shot, my wife tells me, is all the chemicals and additives. What else is in the vaccine other than the disease?
What does that even mean? I mean,
I don't know. I actually wrote question mark to her.
She said,
what else is in the vaccine?
You could say the same thing about any pill or anything else. They put in exactly what they need to make sure that the stuff stays fine. You know, this is, again, where people are just always consumed. They think that the vaccines are full of stuff. And this is even one of the arguments that gets made about how many shots we give kids, that it's too much. Their bodies have to react to too much.
Yeah, a lot of parents, including us, we wanted to space those shots out. Our pediatrician was like, oh, it's fine. There's no evidence that you – no, there's not – it's not okay to space them out.
It's not okay to space it out. It's like you're just – it's not, because it reduces the – you know, it leaves kids at risk for longer periods. No, I don't really care for spacing it out. Having said that the idea is that, you know, first of all, you're ignoring the fact that your kids are bombarded by like a gazillion things a day in the environment that their bodies are reacting to all of the time.
And are they really? I mean, that seems commonsensical, but that's really
I mean, your immunological responses, you're constantly responding to stuff.
So could I say this? Could I say, really, if you really want to know the truth, my child's day, I might as well be pumping 50 shots in them anyway because of the bacteria that they're interacting with anyway.
Well, that's the thing. They're constantly being exposed to germs and things. I mean, just even things in, like, you know, the environment. And not all the stuff is going to make them sick. I'm just saying that, you know, they're exposed to things all of the time. And when they are, their bodies are responding to those things all the time. The human body, as well as, you know, most things, are capable of, you know, responding to tons and tons and tons and tons of antigens all the time. There are estimates that show, this is, I think, in our second book, that the human body is capable of responding to some obscenely large number of antigens at one time, and that, you know, what we put in a vaccine is infinitesimal compared to that. Moreover, it ignores the fact that what we really care about is not how many shots they're getting, but how many different proteins are we exposing to? How many different things do they need to react to in each shot? And our technology has improved so massively that, like, the, say, you know, however many shots it is today, which is much higher than it was years ago, actually has about a tenth as many, if I'm remembering the numbers correctly, a tenth as many antigens total, you know, proteins total, as the old shots had back in the day when they were just getting a few. Because our process is so much more refined now that they're actually responding in the body to exponentially fewer proteins now that their bodies have to react to when they get all of the shots today than they did when they got fewer shots in the past.
The flu shot, 97% of all flu shots contain 25 micrograms of thimerosal, a form of ethyl mercury extremely toxic to humans.
Thimerosal has not been in human vaccines since 2003.
I don't know if my wife's going to believe that.
Well, it's the law! It's like 2003 is when they took mercury out of infant vaccines.
She's on delay. I think she's listening on the app, so I'll have to take her response later.
Thimerosal, I mean, because it's like this is thimerosal. I believe it was two. You know what? I can pull this up on the blog even. I can read you exactly what it is. So I'm walking over to my computer now. But, I mean, you know, thimerosal and mercury vaccines, because this drives me crazy every time somebody tries to blame, you know, autism on the thimerosal, because there has been no thimerosal in vaccines since, you know, 2003. And it's like we have not stopped worrying about the autism epidemic since 2003. Of course, we've talked about this before. You can't turn on the news without hearing how the increase in autism is going up. It can't be due to the mercury because the mercury was removed. Thimerosal.
Mario in New Jersey.
Hi, honey.
Hello, my love.
So, Dr. Carroll.
Yes.
Austin Frack, I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago when he was on, if it gets disheartening that all the policy work that you guys do never seems to get implemented by the powers that be.
Say it again.
I'd like to hear your thoughts on it.
Can you say that one more time? I'm sorry.
I said I asked Austin Frack a couple weeks ago whether it was disheartening when you do all this research and provide great results about effectiveness in certain treatments.
Yes.
And nothing ever seems to get accomplished on, you know, the people that actually do these things or the policymakers don't make these changes.
Well, I mean, it just depends on sort of, I guess, you know, I think it was much more frustrating at the beginning when I truly believed that we would, you know, have much more of an effect immediately. I swear to God, I can remember massive disappointment when our book was published and I was like, well, these myths will be beaten. Like, that will be the end. And, of course, we made no effect whatsoever. None on, I feel like, the United States psyche. So, you know, then you reset your bounds where it's like, if I can just, before I die, convince people that turkey doesn't make them sleepy, that alone I... but it's like, but, you know, you back up. It's like, I do think change happens over time. And I think, I do think that we... And Austin and I, it's funny, because we even had this discussion just a couple weeks ago. Maybe it's hubris. Maybe it's ego, but I do believe that there have been times when I think we have managed to push national discussion, slightly one way or the other because of the blog and because of some of the stuff that we've done.
Tell me about it.
And I don't. So I don't think that it's completely lost. I do see, I do see more than I've seen in the past evidence making its way into discussions of policy. I think that that's one of the reasons that, it is the reason I'm excited to be like part of the Upshot, but that's what the Upshot wants to do. That's what Ezra Klein's new venture wants to do. That's what Nate Silver's venture wants to do. There is a growth in the idea that we need to take data and apply it to areas of policy where data has been lacking in the past.
You said you personally had experience with something that moved the conversation. Can you give me?
I can't prove it, of course, because it's not an RCT and there's no counterfactual. But when there was a big discussion a couple years ago about raising the Medicare eligibility age, we wrote a lot about it. And I mean, it percolated its way into other people with a much higher profile writing about it. And we had some contact from different from senators or congresspeople's offices or other people in power who said, hey, I read your thing and, it worked its way into here or there. And in the end, it went away. And I don't know if it's because of us. I don't. But many of the arguments that we were making and pushing over and over again, trying to say, like, if you do the analyses, if you look at how many people will get cost, what it will cost, what will happen, what might happen with health, I think that those, evidence-based arguments made their way into dialogue and the way people are talking about it. Now, if it might have happened without us, I have no idea. But still, it made me happy to see that is the way that people were talking about it, as opposed to just, using talking points, which is a way that sometimes policy does get made. I don't get as pessimistic about it. Do I wish it was better all the time? Yeah. But I do think that it's better than it used to be.
So, Dr. Carr, can I just ask you about iPad and how difficult you think it's going to be to get it implemented?
iPad. What is iPad?
Oh, okay, the Independent Payment Advisor. I thought you asked about iPads, and I was like, the iPads work great. No, iPad, the Independent Payment Advisory Board, is part of the Affordable Care Act. It is set up to, if Medicare spending rises too quickly, I can't remember if it's a half a point or 1 point above GDP, then this 15-person board makes recommendations to Congress about how to reduce Medicare spending. They are expressly prohibited from rationing, so they can't say, we're not going to pay for this or we're going to withhold that. And other constraints, I think the only way that they'll be able to reduce spending is to reduce reimbursement, which is, of course, going to tick off all the doctors, but that is one thing that they could do. When they make those recommendations to Congress, Congress must overrule them by passing other changes to Medicare that are of equal value, which is not easy these days in Congress, given how dysfunctional it is, or the recommendations of the Independent Payment Advisor Board automatically go into effect. So that gives them much more teeth than they used to have, because they will be the default. In other words, if Congress can't override them or can't find something better, they happen. So this is considered a serious way to try to reduce Medicare spending over time in the future. Having said that, the members of the Independent Payment Advisory Board have to be confirmed by the Senate, which will not be easy, given that the Senate is, if they don't have a filibuster, or even if it's Republican-controlled, they hate the Independent Payment Advisory Board, which means, of course, that it's not this unelected, unapproved body. They have to be confirmed by the Senate. But the larger point is that the Independent Payment Advisory Board only kicks in if Medicare spending rises too quickly. And ironically, in the last 4 years, Medicare spending has been rising so much more slowly than we expected, it would not kick in.
Right. It doesn't mean it can't be formed.
No. It could be. Of course, it's got to be formed only by being, having its members approved by Congress. I can't even see in an election year them putting the people forward, because they probably don't even, the Democrats probably don't even want the fight.
No, I think lame duck is.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be formed anytime soon. I think it will be a major fight once it does. The AMA will go crazy, as will many other industries. It's not going to be popular. Nobody ever likes the actuality of cutting healthcare spending. They only like it in theory. But everybody's sort of like keeping their fingers crossed and hoping that healthcare spending keeps rising as slowly as possible. That's unlikely.
All right. I haven't even been listening to you guys because my wife is just crushing me.
All right, thanks, guys. Thanks,
Carol. Mercury vaccine.
Hold on, Mario. Listen to this. Okay, here's the thing. I'm gonna take the personal public, because this is the thing that I don't understand. We have this ongoing argument. Okay. When I try to think for myself, I try to look up as much as I can.
Right.
But for me, when I see that a study has been done, I'm like most people. I go, wow, a study was done and it came out with that. That's either disconcerting or it's hard to believe. Now, what I can't do, I'll be honest, I don't want to do is learn about the methodology of a study.
Right.
I don't probably have the time or energy or intellect to understand even how that's done. So I don't do it. So what I'll do is I'll look at a study, and I won't decide based on one study on anything. I can't. I don't think that's right. It'll bring up a lot of interesting points. But the reason why that I refer to Dr. Carroll is because that's what he does. He does health research. And a health researcher is, correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Carroll, I really don't know exactly what you do, how you do it, but you understand, you can take a look at a study very quickly or for a long time, and you can take a look at the methodology. And I find the most interesting debates that I listen to are two experts, let's say two scientists or two doctors, that have both looked at a study the same and don't agree on the study, and they cite the methodology. One of the best segments we ever had here on the program was the vegan discussion debate that we had between two doctors. They kept citing the studies, and one would say, yeah, but this study included this and that study included that. So I when my wife says you don't look at the evidence for yourself, you're trusting what Aaron says. I mean, I do look at the evidence, but I cannot break down a study, much less all of the studies. I'm not asking you, Aaron. Mario, what about what I've just said there?
That's true, but the problem is that most people don't even delve as deep as you do. They read the headline, just like the one terrible study about the autism with the and the vaccines, right? The headline gets out, and that's it. It reinforces persons' pre-existing belief, and anything else isn't going to make a difference.
Well, first of all, I want to get back to the thimerosal vaccines, because it's an important.
Well, she tells me that thimerosal vaccines, she said
it's been out of the infant vaccine since 2003. Completely,
it's out of the infant vaccine.
Correct. There are.
But it's in adult vaccines and children vaccines, just as my wife said.
No. Well, it depends which ones. They're really only still in some of the influenza vaccines, and they're in trace amounts in the vast majority of those, and some older ones, I think tetanus and diphtheria. That's it. So all of the other vaccines that your kids are getting, no thimerosal whatsoever. And the concern was not any dose of mercury, because of course people are hit with mercury all the time.
People are hit with mercury all the time?
Well, it's in lots of fish, and unless you're not giving your kids fish or some foods also contain mercury as well.
Is there more mercury in fish than there is in these shots?
I bet they're getting much more in the aggregate, probably.
If you eat a lot of it, you're getting more mercury.
Well, because you eat lots and lots and lots and lots of fish usually, but you get like one shot. Now, there are thimerosal-free influenza vaccines. I don't think you can get them in the U.S. at the moment, but there are thimerosal-free influenza. But even the ones that are left, they're trace amounts. I mean, we're not talking – if your goal is to get to zero exposure of anything, then you can't do life. I mean, there's arsenic in rice. It's just like there are trace amounts, and that's a naturally occurring substance. You can't get to zero. And so the goal is not to say I want no exposure to anything. It's to what is safe. And the amount that is in even in the influenza vaccine right now, is incredibly low.
Why is it in there?
Well, it's a preservative, and we need to. It's one of the, you know, they need to find things to keep the stuff going, you know, to keep it preserved till they can get it to you. It's like nobody manufactures, you know, this stuff and then immediately gives it to you right off the line. This is the way that they've studied to keep them, you know, working and fine. But the biggest thing, but again, it's like here's where the line just shifts. Everything was a problem with the infant vaccines, and we need to space them out, and it's too much because, oh, it's too much mercury. And so they said, fine. And in 2008 and 2003, gone. All of it is gone. And no more in the infant vaccines, no more thimerosal. Did that mean that everybody who'd been making the argument then took the logical leap and said, very good, you've addressed my concerns? No, they just shifted to the next problem that they had with the vaccines. And at some point, you just got to own your anti-vaccine. Or your anti, you know, something about it just rankles you and you don't want it, and you keep grabbing on to things. It's the same thing that I talked about with the mammograms so long ago. At some point, you have to own that it's like, if you can't at some point own that, or at least identify what would make me give you the information that would change your mind. And if it's like, there is no way I'm going to change my mind, then just own that.
That reminds me, Pete, first of all, I like my vaccines freshly juiced without preservative. And second, Jonathan Chait wrote an article about the ACA truthers, right? The enrollment numbers, and he compared it to a vegetarian giving a review for a new barbecue joint.
That was a good piece.
Saying, doesn't matter what doesn't matter what this guy does. There's no way he's going to like that restaurant.
Mario, thank you. I haven't read that piece. We'll get to the ACA after the break. Keith in New York.
Hey there. So you know, I'm just listening and I'm going crazy. Paul Offit, who I'm sure, you know, Dr. Carroll is aware of, did the experiment on vaccines. And one of the things he wanted to find out was how many vaccines a human can incorporate at once.
Yep.
And he found a number that was so high. It was in the hundreds of thousands.
This is what we used in our book. That's the study. Yes, we
and
did.
And Wired Magazine has a phenomenal article where he lays out all of his facts. And I tweeted the article out to you. And people need to read it because Aaron Carroll is right. This is a debate of people saying, oh, you know, the problem is it doesn't take in effect last year's strain. And then they go, oh, we change it each year. Oh, you change it each year? You don't know what the effect is. It's dangerous. No matter what happens and no matter what you say, whatever you just did is now a problem because they are simply anti-vaccine. Now, that being said, I just wanted to address one little thing Pete said about looking at studies. I think Ben Goldacre did a TED Talk where he said, you know, part of a study is not just that it's designed well, but it needs to be replicable. And
yeah, but hold on, stop there. I would never know if a study was designed well. I would never know if it could be repeated.
I wouldn't know that.
I'll never know that.
And I just wanted to say, one of the things he did, and I'm pretty sure it was Ben Goldacre, was he tried taking a bunch of groundbreaking studies, things that people have been relying on for years, and just running them again to see if like they got the same results. And he said there was a startling amount that the second time they ran these things did not come up with the same results. And part of the problem is people don't rerun to great experiments because they're expensive. They're hard to do. So there is a...
All right, let me cut you off there. Dr. Kell, respond to
I want to say, you know, your caller, first of all, two things. One, your caller, I actually grabbed my book and opened it up. So Paul Offit's research showed that infants can probably respond to 10,000 vaccinations at any one time. 10,000 at a time. So we're not even close. And what I said before about the number of shots, when they developed the smallpox vaccine, it had 200 different proteins in it. In 1980s, the 7 vaccines that we gave kids had 2,000 antigens in it. But today, the 11 vaccines that we use have about 125 antigens in it. So the vaccines all summed together, if we gave them all at one time, which we don't, have about half the number of antigens to respond to as just the smallpox vaccine did back in the day. So, again, it's like, well, it's too many. It's not too many. It's first of all, it's not even close to the actual
But it
limit.
Sounds like it's too many. It's when you see your child getting a bunch of shots that have these diseases in them,
I don't know.
Parents get
like
terrified by that.
I agree. So then, you know what they started to do is they started to actually, like, merge them and put them together so that they could, you know, put them all into fewer shots. And then people had different arguments against that. And I don't disagree that it can be traumatic, but what you're describing right now is you're saying it's a problem for you. It's a problem for a parent having to watch it. And that's when my sympathy wanes.
Well, I don't think I'm not saying that. I'm saying
that's what people say.
No, but I don't have a problem with watching. I have a problem with those things all going into my daughters at the same time. I don't. But I don't think parents have a problem watching their kids get shots if they know that it's going to be good for them. They have a problem with the idea of that many things being put in them at once.
But again, that's infinitesimal compared to what the body is prepared to do and what you're being exposed to every day just by walking around.
I've got to take a break. I'm 10 minutes late for it. We'll focus on the Affordable Care Act unless there's the rest of these calls want to focus on what we've been talking about. But we've got to talk about this. We'll be right back with Dr. Aaron Carroll at Aaron E. Carroll, 2 R's, 2 L's. We'll be right back.
He's no nonsense. Speaks his mind. Says what you're thinking and other horrible cliches. Stand up with Pete Domenic.
Indy, Sirius XM 104.
All right, let's quickly go to Brian in Utah for Dr. Aaron Carroll, who has written a lot about the HPV vaccine. I'm trying to get the Affordable Care Act and the announcement of 7.1 million new enrollees, even though Dr. Carroll has been good about not talking about the day-to-day developments, and he certainly doesn't do victory laps. But Brian, go ahead, your question.
Hey, Dr. Carroll, I was just curious. I heard Dr. Drew talking about it on Ellis's show, and it's just kind of weird that they haven't incorporated that in a vaccine for kids yet, and I wonder why.
HPV?
Yes.
You mean for infants? Because we do give it to kids. You just mean for very small children?
Yeah, they are doing that for kids now, so in the future,
one of the things that we in the pediatric, I've discussed with colleagues is sort of interesting. We give the hepatitis, people will say, well, the HPV vaccine is the first, sex vaccine, and that's not really true. The hepatitis B vaccine was the first sex vaccine because, we worry that people will get hepatitis B, one of the ways, through sexual contact, but we didn't want to give it to older kids because, we worried that we wouldn't get too early. So we give it to babies. Hepatitis B is given to babies at, 2, 4, 6 months and, whatever it is. And so we sort of slipped that one in there really early with the idea of you can also get it through, some other ways. It's a bloodborne illness, and you can get it through, many of the same ways you can get other bloodborne illnesses. So that one goes early. Not hepatitis B, but the HPV vaccine, we delayed, and we said, well, we'll give it to kids when they get close to being sexually active. And that put it in this whole spot of now it gets complicated. If the kids are older and it's tied up to sex and everything else. And I've heard anecdotal reports that people have much more success getting people to take the HPV vaccine the earlier they give it. If they give it to really young girls where it doesn't even have to get tied up into a discussion of their sexuality, parents sometimes are like, sure, whatever. But when it's all of a sudden now I have to actually think of my children as being sexually active, it adds on this whole other layer of complication that makes it much more difficult. I think the cat's, it's one of the cows already out of the barn. And so I don't know that we can now change this to why don't we slip this into the infant vaccines or put this into early childhood and just get it done with everything else, because at this point it's become a political football. But you probably would have been better off, and the whole thing would have worked out better if we just made it part of the, childhood vaccines. We just said, when you get your vaccines? When you're a kid, and that's when you get your vaccines. And if we put it in at that point, it probably would have gone much smoother.
Yeah, my wife, she got cervical cancer when she was 16, and she wasn't sexually active.
Well, cervical cancer comes from HPV, so it's not a guarantee. It's not a guarantee, but it does.
That would help, though, right?
Oh yeah, it would absolutely. It would significantly reduce the chance, because a lot of cervical cancer is linked to HPV, and so it would absolutely reduce the risk of getting HPV. It would absolutely
said it was hell going through the procedures to get that out.
I don't doubt it. I mean, no one wants to go through it. Yes, I'm pro-vaccine. And it's funny because it's it's not that I'm pro-vaccine because I woke up one day. They work. They're probably, if not the greatest medical achievement of the last century or two. They're one of them. We've eradicated diseases from the face of the earth, some almost from the face of the earth. There are diseases that, even 20 years ago were very likely to kill a child that I've never seen. And they work, and we start quibbling about this stuff, and it is difficult given the extensive literature. One of the previous callers brought up the, you know, sometimes with one pivotal trial, we change the what we do. And I wrote a piece just a couple weeks ago. You know, the most drugs approved by the FDA have one or two trials behind them. And, you know, the average number of people is like 100 and some. So it's like based on one or two trials of 100 and, you know, 100 people, we said this drug is safe. Everyone can have this drug. Vaccines have gargantuan amounts of studies behind them with hundreds of millions of people, you know, showing that they are safe, showing that they don't have, you know, they don't cause autism, all of these things. And yet people are still like, well, I think I just need one more study. And those same people are willing to often believe incredibly tiny, biased, you know, flawed studies that say what they want to hear on other subjects. Those they treat like gospel, but they will often, you know, take very well designed, huge, enormous studies and say, I just need to see that replicated 40 or 50 more times and then I'll buy, because they know that'll never happen.
Yeah. All right, Brian.
Thank
you very much for the call. The Affordable Care Act, the news yesterday, and the president did a victory lap, 7.1 yeah. million. You know, everybody's trying to break down these numbers, Dr. Carroll. What's important, though?
I don't know. This is one of those where it's like, important for what? If it's important politically, I think 7 million was an important political milestone because they met their benchmark. But, you know, what I think most wonks care about is, did we get enough people in the exchanges to sort of have a critical mass and make the actuarial numbers work? Do we have a critical, you know, proportion of healthy to unhealthy people in such a way that we don't go into a death spiral, and that, you know, that the predictions that the insurance companies made about premiums are not so low that next year premiums go up so high that it becomes some sort of shock and panic and everybody starts abandoning the exchanges. Those are the things people care about. We don't know the answers to those yet, which is why I still, you know, don't write about this stuff, because, you know, everybody wants to cover this like a horse race, and it is not. We will have to wait and see. We'll have to wait and see who signed up, how many people actually, you know, got the policies, how much did they actually cost after a year? Mm-hmm. Were the guesses correct? Were they high? Were they low? But, you know, I think what most writers are covering these days is it successful enough that it will be difficult to take away? That's, I think, what most, you know, people who oppose the law are concerned about. It's also, I think, what most people who support the law are worried about. They want to know that, you know, if they get enough people into this, they're not going to be able to take it away. And I think we're approaching that point if we're not there already. I'm seeing even a lot of conservative writers, you know, start to shift and be like, you got to get over this. You know, it's not imploding. It's not falling apart. It's not the end of days. And the longer that you just hold out waiting for it to just, you know, crash under its own weight, it looks very unlikely, given that many of the predictions that people made about how people would sign up and how it would go are coming true. And, you know, it is only going to sort of increase because it is not as it met. There is no Medicaid open enrollment. Medicaid enrollment will continue for the rest of the year. The open enrollment period for next year starts again in the fall. It's not that far away, which more people will likely sign up for insurance. And so it's moving. It's moving, you know, and it has a fairly large amount of momentum behind it. So I think it's important from the sense of it may shift the discussion from repeal to, okay, this really might be here to stay and we have to start working on trying to fix it.
We're talking to Dr. Aaron Carroll at Aaron E. Carroll on Twitter. And, of course, the Incidental Economist is the blog, and now writing for the Upshot on the New York Times as well. Xander in Illinois.
Pete Tomek, how are you doing?
Hey, buddy.
All right. What I wanted to talk about, the Affordable Care Act, it kind of frustrates me when I hear media coverage, is the Affordable Care Act has all these ways that it's trying to save money. iPad was one of the great examples.
Yep.
One of them. And it's just also there's talk about how a lot of people aren't getting the drugs that they want because they'll cover generics. Or it's just all these ways that they try to keep costs down. People get upset when they don't get the doctors they want or the procedures they want or the drugs they want. And so prices just keep going up and up, and then just people just don't realize that because they are always getting what they wanted, that's why prices won't go down.
Yeah. Well, it's just, this is one of the greatest frustrations, I think, of, you know, people that are on the policy side, is everybody wants less spending, just not for them. They just want less spending for everybody else. It's like, I want less spending, but certainly not for whatever diseases I might have or my friends might have or my family might have. And I don't want them to spend too much on drugs, but they certainly better cover my drugs. And I don't want, you know, studies on wasteful tests, but that MRI isn't wasteful. I need that MRI. And so it all sounds great in theory, but when the rubber hits the road, everybody loses their mind. It's interesting that you bring up things like, you know, generic drugs over full price drugs, or, you know, not seeing the doctor you want, because it's always important to remember that those are the means by which private insurance is reducing its spending. Medicare is prohibited. In fact, they just redid the policy that said, you know, Medicare can't restrict its formulary that much, the Medicare Part D plans. Private insurance plans absolutely can, but the government can't. So you're much more likely on the government plans to be able to see almost any doctor you want and to also get any drug you want. It's on private insurance that narrow networks really come into play, and it's in private insurance that we start talking about formularies and restricting medications and coming up with these ways. These are the ways that the private market, that the free market, that private insurance, though, that's how they reduce spending. And the Affordable Care Act doesn't tell them how to do it. The Affordable Care Act is just trying to slow the rate at which we spend money on health care. And private insurance is reacting to that by trying to find ways to save money so that they don't wind up getting screwed. And this is how they do it. And then everybody gets angry. And then they blame the government. And they blame the Affordable Care Act. But that's how private insurance tries to spend less money. And at some point, we either have to own as a, you know, collective society that we want to spend less money, or and then own what that means and how it's getting done, or at least be honest about it. But we're very irrational. We don't really handle it very well at all.
Dr. Aaron Carroll, we're out of time. Thank you very much for joining us today. Xander, thanks for the call. Everybody else, great calls. We appreciate it. We will see you, sir, next week. You'll be in New York.
I will be in New York.
And I'll be in Indianapolis the week after at Morty's Comedy Joint in Indianapolis. Dr. Carroll will be there with me. You should come out and meet both of us April 17th, 18th, and 19th. We will be there. Check out Dr. Aaron Carroll at the Incidental Economist. Thanks, pal.